again on the or finish up the section on self-deception. I have to expose some of my self-deception yesterday. I was pointed out an error I made logically, and so I want to thank one of Henry Johnson's sons for pointing this out to me. I said that the law of contradiction is, it's not the case A and, excuse me, not the case A and not A, and that is correct. And I said the law of the excluded middle is A or not A, and that is not quite correct, because these are equivalent. This is basically the law of contradiction. If you know anything about De Morgan's theorem, these are equivalent. And so this tells us the same thing as this, so let me complete it. The answer, the real, this is telling us that it's A or A, not A, one of the two, but the vel, or the or, in the logic is inclusive, means both can be true. And so to get the bivalence, you need to add a conjunction and of let's see, like this A and not A. Okay, let's see. A or not A, that's right, and it's not the case. Right, so this is the law of bivalence. We had to add that conjunction to it. This is one or the other, but not both. A or not A, but not both A and not A. So I apologize for the sloppiness yesterday. Now let's conclude our section on self-deception. We talked about the issue of self-deception. We talked about why that's important to presuppositional apologetics, because the Bible and presuppositional apologetics talks about man believing one thing and not believing it, right? The Bible tells us what in Romans chapter 1? All men know God, but in other places the Bible says men do not know God. So how can it be both? How can men know God and not know God? How can it be that people deceive themselves when they are both the ones that with the privileged information trying to deceive, and also with the same privileged information being deceived by it? How could you ever be successful at that? But we know we are by our own experience. I mentioned literature. How many of you are Jane Austen fans? All the women. Oh, good, men too. I like Jane Austen. Jane Austen's books are filled with self-deception, right? What is a famous line in Pride and Prejudice that Elizabeth says after she read the note from Darcy, that's a different one. After she read the note from Darcy at the big confrontation at, wasn't it, Rosings? What did she say? I never, until this day, what? Knew myself, right? She thought of herself one way, but after reading something that he wrote, she thought she saw something that she never saw in herself. What about Emma? What did Emma think of herself as? A matchmaker. She knew how to match people up, but she didn't see what? She didn't see that she got lucky one time, right? She got lucky, and after that, her matchmaking didn't turn out too well. She didn't even understand herself and who she really loved, and at the end, she comes to realize that she had deceived herself. And that's just one novelist, right? Throughout our literature, we find the issue of self-deception. In our own lives, we study self-deception. It's something that is part of human experience. It's a very fascinating thing. I mean, there's the philosophical issues of it we're talking about, but the implications of self-deception are vast. I mean, the ability that we have to believe things, that we get ourselves to believe things that we know are not true, is fascinating about human nature. And it tells us something about the depth of our sin. Right? That's why the Bible tells us what? God knows the heart of the man. We don't even know our depths. God does, but we don't. We can't trust ourselves. One of the things that is taught by Cartesian philosophy and that is accepted by many, has been accepted by many, is that we have privileged access to our mental states, that we can't be wrong about what we believe, what we think. Right? This is at the heart of Cartesian epistemology, but we know better than that, don't we? We know that we really can come to false beliefs, not about the world only, that's obvious. Not about God only, that's obvious too, but about ourselves. So Cartesianism is a faulty philosophy, not just because of issues about its errors regarding our knowledge of the world and God, but about knowledge even of ourselves. So self-deception is prevalent, it's with us, and it tells us something about the deep waters of sin that are in our hearts. Now, remember, the question is not one of the experience of it, but one of the possibility of it. How is it psychologically possible to deceive yourself when you are the one who is both the deceiver and the one being deceived? Now, we put it on the board this way yesterday. S believes P, and S believes not P. Now remember, our criticism wasn't that this was a contradiction, right? Logically, it's not a contradiction, but it seems to be psychologically contradictory, right? How can you believe something and not believe something without it being embedded implicitly in other things, right? And we can do that, right? We may not know all of what all of our beliefs entail, and so we can hold beliefs that are inconsistent, but how can we consciously hold beliefs that are inconsistent? This seems to be a problem, right? It seems to be the only people that could really do this are what we would call crazy people, right? Knowingly believing something and at the same time not believing it. Well, Bahnsen in his dissertation said that this is problematic as it stands, but this isn't the correct analysis. The correct analysis is to talk about what? You have to introduce the notion of orderings of belief or orders of beliefs. Right? We talked about yesterday that we have first order beliefs. I believe that there is a podium in front of me. But I also have a belief, now that I'm thinking about it, that I believe that I have that belief. Right? So there's no issue with that. And we can have third order and fourth order of beliefs. But all we need for this analysis is two orders of belief. And Bahnsen contends that what is happening with the self-deceiver is that he believes P, you could put it either way, I'm going to say he believes not P, right? He believes that his children are not good, right? But he also believes that he believes he, his child, is good. Okay, so you have here no psychological contradiction. You have a different order or different level of beliefs. One can therefore believe something and also have a false belief about his own mental state. And that, of course, is not logically contradictory, but it's not even, at least it doesn't seem obviously to be, psychologically contradictory. Now, that's not to say that there's no psychological tension going on. But on a formal analysis, there doesn't seem to be any contradiction psychologically. Nevertheless, there's a tension between these, right? And so, when you deceive yourself, what do you have to constantly do? You have to always be on the guard, right? Because your first-order belief is always rising to the surface, and so your second-order belief has to be what? Reinforced, right? Reinforced. Push down. You push down. I don't believe this. I know this to be the case, but I don't believe that I believe that. Constantly pushing it down. Sounds like what? Romans 1, right? All men know God, but they do what? Push it down, right? Yes, 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 yes. Get it down, right? Bahnsen's illustration used to be like the guy at the beach party and pool party with the beach ball. Right, you always have the beach ball there. You play your pool volleyball, and then there's always the guy who thinks he's so funny, and he takes the ball and does what with it? He pushes it down, sits on it, and says, "Where's the ball? Where's the ball?" Right, and what is happening? He's sitting on it, and as soon as the pressure's off, it will pop up. Right, he is suppressing it. He's pushing it down. It's always trying to rise to the surface. That's what's going on. So if you have any type of belief that you're suppressing, it's a constant work. So your first order belief is always trying to rise to the surface. And your second order belief is trying to push it down. And it has to be an activity, right? Many of our beliefs are beliefs that we don't have to have or maintain, right? Almost all of our beliefs like that. We believe that human beings live on planet Earth. Right now, did any of you believe that? Or anybody not believe that? We all believe that, right? Is it hard for you to maintain that belief? I know it, but seems to be true. I got to think about that today. No, most of our beliefs are beliefs that we don't have to work at. But in self-deception, to believe this way causes us to work at it. You have to constantly work at it. So you have to, it involves intentions here. Now, this is going to be the last point that Bahnsen makes in his dissertation. I'm not going through all of it, but the last point is, seems to be a problem here. There seems to be a problem with the notion of intention. How can you intend to deceive yourself? What kind of intention intends to suppress something that is constantly rising to the surface? How can you intend to do something that you know you're intending to do, and yet if you're successful in your intention, then what? Then you no longer have your intention, right? You no longer realize your intention, right? Because the self-deception works, then you're going to have to cover up your intention. And Bahnsen calls self-deception, if it's successful, a intention that is self-covering, right? I intend to deceive myself, right? And we know it, right? When we're trying to believe something false about ourselves, we have to try. It's not automatic. It's not like our belief that there are human beings on planet Earth. It's something we have to try to do because we know we don't have that belief in the first order way. So in order to develop the second order belief, we have to try to do it. So we have to intend to do it. But if we maintain that intention, then it's going to defeat itself, isn't it? If we know our intention all along, at the end of the day, it's going to be obvious that we're not going to be able to believe something that we know is not true about ourselves, unless we can do what? Cover that intention somehow. Forget it. Put it aside. And so Bahnsen says what the nature of self-deception, what it entails, is that they are self-covering in nature. The intention to deceive is self-covering. Now, that's a claim at this point, right? And so he gives an analogy. His analogy is what everybody hopefully did last night relatively early. Fall asleep, right? What do you tend to do when you go to bed? Tend to fall asleep, unless you have your books with you, right? Even then you tend to fall asleep, right? Well, I'm going to read until I fall asleep. But you intend to, when you go to bed, fall asleep. What's the worst way to fall asleep? As a former insomniac, I know this from experience. What's the worst thing you can do to try to fall asleep? Try to fall asleep, right? Okay, I'm going to sleep now, right? It's 9 o'clock. I've got to get up early. I'm going to go to sleep. I've got to get to sleep right away. You look over the clock. I'm not asleep yet. It's now 10 o'clock. And what happens? Oh, no, I've got to get to sleep. Then it's 11 o'clock. And then you what? You start panicking. It's 12 o'clock. I'm never going to get up, right? I'm never going to get any sleep, right? So the insomniac's problem, typically, is that he's trying too hard. But you have to try to go to sleep, on the other hand, to go to sleep. Not necessarily. I mean, there's some people that can sleep anywhere. Some people try not to, and they are not successful in trying not to. But most of us have not trouble falling asleep, but we intend to fall asleep. Now, how is that possible? Well, what happens? Well, when you do fall asleep, you do what? And I'm saying do and not in an intentional sense, but what does happen? Well, as soon as you're successful with your intention to fall asleep, and you do fall asleep, that intention what? Goes away, right? Falls away. It's no longer there. And so Bahnsen maintains that this is an example of a self-covering intention. Now, I don't like to demur from my mentor and somebody that's much greater than me, Greg Bahnsen, but I find a problem with this as an analogy. I want to see if you think of a problem with it. What's the problem with this analogy between self-deception and sleeping? Okay, that's certainly true. It doesn't involve continual self-consciousness, so that may be an issue. What's another issue with it? What type of thing is... Well, let's think of it this way. This is maybe another way of stating that objection. Self-deception is a what type of activity? It's a mental activity, right? It's a mental activity. What kind of activity is sleeping? Well, it's mental in a sense, right? But it's also physical, right? It's biological. It's physical. Your body shuts down. And we can read the brain waves. They change, right? The breathing patterns change. The heart rate changes. You know, you can study their eyes go up into the sockets, and sometimes they move rapidly. It's a different physiological state, and it's something that you're going to do no matter how hard you try not to eventually, right? You're going to eventually fall asleep. It's a, your body will shut down. And so the problem I have with it is not that it's not that it's helpful, it's not that his example is not helpful, it's that it could be picked at by those that would demur or argue against his account, because they could simply claim that, well, that is a physiological, sleep has a physiological basis, whereas self-deception does not. Okay, but I still think, saying all that, and I think there's something to that. Right? I mean, it is true that sleeping, though you may intend to, eventually it's your body, in a sense, that takes over. Sleeping is odd, isn't it? I mean, we thank God for sleep, and it's such a nice thing to do, but isn't it odd that there is such a thing as sleep, that you close your eyes and really don't know much about what's going on? I mean, there's still some minimal sensations. That's why you can wake up if you hear a loud crash or something. But other than that, you're in a completely different state. What's going on there? I don't know. I don't know how it all happens. But it's a lot of it is physiological. And so this isn't an exact analogy. But I think it's at least helpful, right? I don't know if it's exactly an example of a self-covering intention, but it's enough to help us. So what is the answer? Is there something that we can make an analogy to? I haven't thought of one. I'm not sure. But I don't think that should bother us too much. The notion that we can cover our intentions successfully doesn't seem to be, to me at least, a big issue because of the complexity of human nature. Most of the objections, as I mentioned before, to this are people in the Cartesian tradition that says, well, you have complete, pure access to human mental states. At least the ego has perfect access to its own mental states. Now, we have no reason to believe as Christians the Cartesian psychological theory. Now, if somebody's coming from a Cartesian perspective and criticizing this issue of self-deception, I think Bahnsen goes a long way in showing that, no, it doesn't have the contradictions that you believe it has. But if they move it on and say, well, look, I mean, it just doesn't work. This notion of self-covering intention doesn't work according to our Cartesian view. Then I think the thing to say at that point is what? This is no longer trying to explain some what pervasive experience. Now you're doing a critique of one worldview on the basis of another worldview, right? You're taking your Cartesianism and using it as a basis to criticize this notion of self-deception. And the answer to that is, on the Christian worldview, this notion of self-deception, a self-covering intention because of the complexities of human nature, is not an issue at all. We're not Cartesian. We don't believe we have perfect access to our mental states. In fact, the Bible tells us that we don't have perfect access to our mental states. And by implication, it tells us that there can be intentions that we have that may very well be covered over. And so on the Christian worldview, self-deception, even at a psychological level, is not an issue at all. So the only way to ultimately criticize self-deception is from a non-Christian perspective. But from a Christian point of view, there's no problem. But then we can go and destroy Cartesianism on its own grounds. So it doesn't have any ability to really affect us after all. Moreover, what's even greater is, I think, that we can take this analysis that Bahnsen provides and show that given that there's self-deception, and most of us take it as a given, not just us as Christians, but most people, most philosophers, most psychologists, we're not behavioral psychologists or cognitivists, but most psychologists would say that there is self-deception. Our experience in our literature has been that there's self-deception. And what is nice about this is that from the Christian worldview, we can explain exactly how it works. Or not exactly, but give an account of how it works. in its broad outline. And so not only does this, which Bahnsen thought he did, show that there is no good objection to Vantillianism because of its belief in self-deception, but it actually provides us with a good argument for Christianity, because Christianity can give an account of what is a common human experience. And one of the things we're going to talk about today is the transcendental argument. And the transcendental argument takes something in our experience, whatever it is, and does what with it? It shows that the non-believing worldview cannot give an account for it. Right? They cannot give a philosophical justification. They cannot give the preconditions to certain types of experiences, speaking of the specific ones. Whereas the Christian worldview can. And so here we have an example where we can supply a transcendental for self-deception. If we take self-deception as a given, right, as a given, we all can agree upon it. If you take that as a given, then we can provide the transcendentals for self-deception. Whereas unbelievers in their worldviews, the Cartesians and others, cannot give the preconditions for it. Okay, so self-deception, a common human practice, but something that some critics of presuppositionalism have said cannot be. There cannot be real self-deception. Okay? And the Bible teaches it, not only presuppositionalism. The Bible teaches that there are people that deceive themselves. So how do we explain this in a way that is consistent with Christianity? Bahnsen's work on this, I think, is very helpful in this regard. By the way, his dissertation I just heard is available from Covenant Media Foundation, but he had another article that was printed in the Westminster Theological Journal. I don't know the year or the volume number, but if you go online, I'm sure you can find it. But he has an article there where he talks about self-deception and encapsulates what he does in his dissertation and makes it more biblical. In other words, he takes his examples from the biblical examples and he applies it more directly to presuppositional apologetics. So if you're interested in this topic, that would be the place I would send you to next. In the chapter on Van Til, the Van Til Reader, there is a section on self-deception as well. So read that first, but if you want more, read that article in the Westminster Theological Journal. Okay, any questions about self-deception? Don't deceive yourself if you don't think you have questions. No questions about it. Well, this is great. You understand self-deception now. Okay, section number 7, the transcendental argument for God's existence. Now, I've got to warn you, things are going to get a little technical. This is a seminary course. I see some younger folks here. So I have to warn you that this may be a little difficult. Now, you're not going to have a problem. You're going to come up and teach the class and correct me after I'm gone. But otherwise, it's going to be something that is a little more difficult than what we've done so far. So I'm warning you ahead of time. What we're going to do now is look at the transcendental argument. I'm going to overview it for you again, okay, so that we're at least somewhat clear as to what this argument is. And then we're going to walk through some of the basic criticisms of this argument. And then we're going to look at how we defend it from these criticisms. Now, in order to do this, some of the objections are I won't say technical, but I'd say quite involved. So it may be a little involved. So put on your concentration caps. This whole morning and some of this afternoon is going to be somewhat arduous. Now, if you like philosophy, you're going to, I think, enjoy it. But if philosophy is something that you don't care for that much, then there's always the coffee in the room out there, and you can come back in and out at your pleasure, unless you're taking it for credit and you're not allowed to go anywhere. So what is the transcendental argument again? What is a transcendental argument? Well, I haven't used the term very often. I've used the term indirect argument. But transcendental argument. First of all, what is an argument? Let's start with basics. What is an argument? Any of you like Monty Python? Pardon me? That's right. This guy, it's just silly stuff, right? The sillier the comedy is, the more I like it. And so there's a guy that goes into a room. He goes into some shop or some building and wants an argument. So he pays for an argument. Right? Well, come to any church, right? You'll get one. Come to our apologetics conference. You'll get an argument. He goes and pays for an argument. And so he goes into this room and says something, and the guy who is supposed to be his opponent just contradicts everything he says. He says, "This is an argument. You're just contradicting me." He says, "I'm not." It goes on from there. Just really silly. Oftentimes people think that type of thing is an argument, right? Where you have people disagreeing and yelling at each other, right? Arguments often tend to increase in volume as they go along, right? I had an argument with my sister. That means you think about, yeah, that we were looking at Kant, and she thought the transcendental analytic taught a skeptical transcendental argument, but I think it's more of a priori argument. And my sister and I were really arguing over that. You don't think of that, do you? When brother and sister are arguing, they're doing what? That's mine. No, that's mine. Right? That's what we think of as an argument. That's not an argument, but we're interested in. What is an argument? A proposition of truth? Well, arguments involve propositions, right? And hopefully they involve truth. But we need a little more meat on that skeleton. So what else? They involve propositions. They involve more than one proposition, right? It is raining. That can't possibly be an argument as it stands with no context around it, right? So what else do you need to have an argument? Well, you have to have one proposition, at least, that you do what? That you assert. You can say assert or conclude, right? You conclude something on the basis of what? At least one other proposition. And this is often called the what? The conclusion is what is asserted, what you claim is asserted by or follows from these other propositions at the conclusion, and what is the, you can call it sloppily, evidence or basis premise. Now you need at least one premise. Right? So you have a premise, at least one, and a conclusion. Right? And there's different types of arguments. The two arguments that most people are aware of, two types, are called deductive and inductive. Inductive. I thought there was going to be somebody even more clever and say non-deductive. Yeah, that would be good too. Deductive and inductive. A deductive argument is an argument where the conclusion at least claims to follow from the premises. And follow is somewhat of a technical term. That means that if the premises are true, then what? The conclusion is true. Right? You can't, if you accept the premises, if the premises are true, and it is a valid deductive argument, then you are forced to draw this conclusion, right? Now I'm speaking in psychological terms. You're not forced to. It has nothing to do with our beliefs or psychology. But it means that if these are true and it's valid, then this follows. This is true as well. Right, we're not forced to do many things. Right, you can give people good arguments and they're not going to necessarily agree with the conclusion. That's why people need to understand at the beginning that logic and argumentation have nothing to do with psychology, how people think. Right, that's why it's a mistake to call logic a study of the laws of thought. It's not the laws of thought, because you've studied how people think, which would be somewhat of an empirical science, right? Studied how people think, then you're going to get lots of things besides logic, right? I mean, what, you know, how some people think, I have no idea, right? I mean, some people that you meet, the way they speak, it's like one sentence doesn't follow from the other sentence in any reasonable way that I can understand. So it's not the study of how people think, it's a study of how people perhaps ought to think, or the study of good reasoning. How to distinguish good reasoning from bad, or good arguments from bad. So an argument is one that is a group of propositions from which another proposition is inferred. A deductive argument is one in which it is claimed that if you accept the premises are true, then the conclusion is also true. Right? So what's the famous example of a deductive argument? And some of you have heard of modus ponens. And by the way, never use Latin phraseology unless it's accepted in English idiom. Right? That's why we say, always say, for example, if you're talking about fallacies, appeal to the mob rather than the fallacy ad populum. Right? Don't use the Latin. But you can use the Latin when it comes to modus ponens because we have no other name for it in English. Right? So this is a stylistic point. So use young students, write this down. Never use a Latin phrase, or even worse, a Greek phrase, when a good English phrase is available. Unless you want to sound uppity. And we don't want to sound that, do we? Okay, so, unless you're into, well, I won't say anything about Moscow, Idaho, but they like that type of thing. Okay, so modus ponens is an argument like this. If P, then Q, and you can substitute anything, right? These are sentence letters, they're called, and they just, you can pop in there any sentence or proposition you want. Peter is an apostle, right? Proposition. John is the beloved disciple. That's a proposition, right? So any ones you want. If P, this is an, this arrow means an if-then clause. If P, then Q. P, therefore what? I know it's Q, that's right, Q. If P, then Q, P, therefore Q. This is a valid argument. Whatever P and Q are, doesn't matter. Q follows from it. Q follows from it. Now, that is, this is called a valid argument. It's a valid deductive argument. Whenever the propositions are true, the conclusion is also true. Valid argument. Now, let's take this one. If P, then Q, Q, therefore P. Let me give you an example. If John Calvin wrote the Institutes, okay, John Calvin wrote the Institutes, then he is a premier theologian. Okay? John Calvin is a premier theologian, therefore what? John Calvin wrote the Institutes. Now, that's a completely above board argument, right? You accept these, you have to accept that. Everybody agreed? Shake your head if you agree. Come on. Shake your head. Come on, raise your hand if you agree. Everybody, raise your hand. Simon says, raise your hand. Okay, I only feel a few of you. No, this is not a good argument. Now, here's how you can tell it's not a good argument. Let's switch it around a bit. Let's use another one. If Robert L. Dabney wrote the Institutes, he is a great author. Robert Dabney wrote the Institutes, then he's a premier theologian. Robert Dabney is a premier theologian, therefore what? He wrote the Institutes. Ah, see, that's not going to work, is it? Right, so you got to be careful. This is an example of an invalid argument. It's invalid argument. Because whenever the premises are true, it doesn't mean that the conclusion will also be true. There are instances of this where the premises are true and the conclusion is false. So this is invalid. By the way, there's a name for this fallacy. What is that? Affirming the consequent, right? And logicians called this the antecedent and this the consequence. Grammarians usually calls this the protasis and this the antithesis. So it just depends, but the logicians like antecedent, consequent. So this is an example of fallacy. So just because you have a deductive argument doesn't mean it's a good one, meaning it's a valid one. Now, one more thing before we move on from deductive arguments, and that is there's a distinction between validity and soundness. Let me give you a valid argument. This is going to upset you. Well, probably not really, but it may upset you. If, what's the guy's name? Hutchinson, what's his name? Christopher Hutchins. If Christopher Hutchins argues that God does not exist, then God does not exist. Christopher Hutchins argues that God does not exist, therefore, God does not exist. Is that a good argument? Well, be careful here. Let me ask you this way. Is that a valid argument? That is. That's a valid argument. Now we're all crushed. That's a valid argument. What are we doing at this conference? God does not exist. Well, that's a valid argument, but does it mean the conclusion is true? Does it mean that the conclusion is true? No, of course not. Why not? Because validity is interested in the form of an argument. It's just a formal conception. Remember, if these premises are true, whenever the premises are true, the conclusion also is also true. That's a valid argument. And the argument I just gave you is a perfectly valid argument. However, that doesn't mean it is what logicians call a sound argument. A sound argument. A sound argument is one in which, as is an argument that is valid, and the premises are indeed true. Okay? They are true. Now let's look at that argument again from that perspective. Soundness, by the way, is interested in truth. Validity is interested in form. So is this a sound argument? Let's take the second premise. Christopher Hutchins argues that God does not exist. Is that true or false? True. Right, I have the article right here. It's true. So far, so good. What about the first premise? If Christopher Hutchins argues that God does not exist, then God does not exist. Is that true? Well, I don't even think Christopher Hutchins would agree with that one, right? Just because somebody argues against something doesn't mean what they're arguing is the case, of course. Right? This premise here is false. It's false. And therefore, the argument is said to be valid, but what? If it's not sound, it's unsound. It's not sound. It's not a sound argument. It's not a sound argument. By the way, how about this? Either God exists or God does not exist. It's not the case that God does not exist, therefore God exists. Is that a valid argument? Yes, it is. Is it a sound argument? Yes, it is. You know, that doesn't mean atheists will be accept that argument, but we believe that both the premises are true and the form is certainly valid. Right, so we have the disputes even over the truth. We have oftentimes disputes over the truth of the premises. But here's an argument, the one I just gave is obviously an argument that is valid but not sound. Okay, so we distinguish between those. So deductive arguments are those which have premises, have a conclusion, and the conclusion is said to follow from the premises if the form is valid. Okay, most of you have had some of this before, right? Most of you have some idea of what a valid deductive argument is. Now let's move on to the next type of argument, and that is, by the way, I'll put these on the board, deductive and inductive. Now, an inductive argument is an argument that has premises and a conclusion, right? Our general definition of an argument is a group of propositions used to support another proposition, right? Or one proposition asserted on the basis of other propositions. So it's going to take generally the same form as any other as a deductive argument. It's going to be different, though. And that is the conclusion of a deductive argument. Let me say R here. Is given support by or is evidenced by certain other propositions. P, Q, S, A. Okay. But it doesn't follow from them. In an inductive argument, the conclusion does not follow from the premises. The premises lend support to the conclusion. So, we argue that, let's say this, there is no mountain east of the Mississippi taller than 10,000 feet. Yeah, I think that's true, but I'm not sure. Now, we can provide evidence for that, right? Evidence for that. The tallest mountain in Georgia, which is, I don't know which one, in the West Coast we call them hills, but we call them mountains out here, I suppose. The tallest mountain in Georgia is less than 10,000 feet. The tallest mountain in Virginia is less than 10,000 feet. Right? And then we could take some other evidence such as, and in my explorations of the East Coast, I've never come across in other states a mountain that is higher than 10,000 feet. Right, so you have different premises here. And so we could draw the conclusion from that that there are no mountains west of the east of the Mississippi higher than 10,000 feet. Now, that is an inductive argument because the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises. It may be true, but it doesn't follow from those premises. Now, you can evaluate inductive arguments, therefore, not in terms of validity or invalidity. Right, that's the wrong way of looking at them. You evaluate them in terms of strength or weakness. Right? You can say that an inductive argument is strong or it's weak. And these are not absolute terms. Right? You can have something stronger or weaker. So I can strengthen this argument by adding other premises, right? I can add another premise that in the states of Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Rhode Island, there are no mountains over 10,000 feet. Does that strengthen the argument? Yes, it does. It strengthens it. I can weaken the argument. I've never been to Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Louisiana. Well, Louisiana won't really. There's a bit of it, I guess, east of Mississippi and Alabama. I've never been to those states. That would do what? Weaken the argument, right? So depending upon what you add, it could either strengthen or weaken it. But the conclusion never necessarily follows from the premises. You can say that it's very strong probability that's true, or a weak probability. In fact, we call some arguments fallacies based upon induction that are very weak inductions. How about this one? This is an inductive argument, and you tell me if it's strong or not. I read in the paper yesterday that a Mexican held up a liquor store in downtown Atlanta. And on the way over here this morning, I was cut off in my car by a Mexican. Mexicans are no good. They're just no good. Is that a good argument? Well, that's an inductive argument, right? Is that a good argument? we're not asking if it's good enough for some people. We're asking if it's good enough for right people, right? Right-thinking people. Is that a good argument? No, why not? Because how many Mexicans are there in the world? I don't know, lots, right? More than two. Lots more than two. Millions. Now, my experience has been what? Two of them. Now, is it fair to draw a conclusion about a whole group of people on the basis of the experience of two of them? No, of course not. Of course not. So that is called a very weak inductive argument, so weak that we have a name for it. It's a fallacy. It's called a what? And we know this in your study. You young ones have studied informal fallacies, I'm sure. What's the name of it? There you go. Hey, you said you didn't like logic. Oh, you didn't like philosophy. Well, I take that as the same thing. So you're divided. So you're a very compartmental thinker. We've got to try to integrate everything. Right, that's a hasty generalization. It's a generalization that's too hasty. Right, what if you take a generally true theory, right, something that's generally true, and apply it to every particular that falls under that generalization. What's that called? That's a sweeping generalization, right? What's some of the sweeping generalizations in our culture? White men can't jump, right? What that means is compared to black men, right? And there's the true, right? White men can't jump. Does that mean that I don't know the name of any white jumpers? Well, let's say Bob Buford. He is the world champion long jumper, right? White men can't jump, generally true, right? You're not going to get wrong in most cases, but you say, well, therefore Bob Buford can't jump. Well, that's not true, right? That's a sweeping generalization. The point is that inductive arguments can be strong or weak, but they're never going to get you to conclusions that are sure, like deductive arguments. Now, here's a question. Which is the better trick question? What's the better type of argument? A deductive argument or an inductive argument? What's the best type? Now let me ask you another question. What's a better tool, a hammer or a screwdriver? No, I'm not. I'm asking you, one or the other. What's the best one, hammer or a screwdriver? Right. Depends on the job, right? You can't say the hammer is the best, right? Although if you're like me and you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? I had a friend that said that he has three tools in his toolbox, a hammer, a screwdriver, and a Visa card. That's close to me. I'd like to have more than that, but there is no best tool. Depends on your job. So what is the best argument, a deductive argument or inductive argument? Most people are tempted to say a deductive argument. Why? The conclusion follows, right? There's no question here. Well, but not everything in life is conducive, right? Not every argument is conducive to this type of analysis. There's some things that just aren't going to give you that type of conclusion. So it depends what it is. There's not one better than the other. Okay, we've got a break now. Okay, break, and we'll